200 years after Josquin's death, the colonization of North America was well underway. We had some universities that would one day achieve greatness. We had some notable cities. Music, of course, was a presence here, but it was largely imported from Europe. The importation of musicians was also beginning. In a 1936 Musical Quarterly article, Virginia Larkin Redway described what she called the first recorded American concert. Of course, there were no tape recorders when she wrote the article. She was talking about the first American concert of which we have any record. It took place at 6 p.m. January 21st, 1736, at a tavern in New York City. The cost was 4 shillings, and the performer is a surprise. He was Theodor Pachelbel. Theodor, son of Johann Pachelbel, showed up in Boston 6 years earlier. We all know the elder Pachelbel for his famous canon, if nothing else. The Pachelbels and the Bach family had been close. Theodor's father had taught music to one of the Bach brothers, and young Theodor had been Bach's contemporary. They'd known each other. Theodor played keyboard instruments. He also composed some music, but the only piece anyone remembers is a choral Magnificat. Skimpy colonial records say little about Theodor's first few years here. By 1733, he was well enough known to be called from Boston by a church in Newport, Rhode Island. They'd bought an English pipe organ and needed him to install it. Then, 2 concerts in New York. Finally, he turns up at St. Philip's Church in Charleston, South Carolina, where he's mentioned in newspaper accounts. He died in 1750, the same year as his old friend Johann Sebastian Bach. Theodor married soon after he arrived in Charleston. 2 years later, a son was born. It seems that he contributed to the local Negro schoolhouse. Yet, when he died, the biggest assets in his estate were 2 slaves, valued at £330. That strikes a discordant note, because the German Protestant world of the 17th century, the world that spawned the Bachs and the Pachelbels, was one place in the Western world where slavery gained no foothold. Theodor had, it seems, adapted fully to the local culture, and yet he'd also brought with him the music that would eventually help to civilize this harsh new world that he'd chosen for his own. Pachelbel represents the avenue by which music was entering the colonies, but music would have to become indigenous, and a very surprising figure in the domestication of music would be Benjamin Franklin. We all know Franklin for a statesman, a scientist, a writer, an inventor, a printer, but he also had his hands in music. He played several instruments, and he composed as well. You may be among the few who've actually heard his string quartet. It still gets played in a concert here and there. If we go to Franklin's treatise on electricity, of all places, we find letters on many topics beyond his foundational work on electricity. His friend, Father Beccaria, in Italy, for example, has sent him a new study of electricity, and Franklin apologizes for having nothing to send back on the subject, but, he says, "It may be agreeable to you, as you live in a musical country, to have an account of a new instrument that seems peculiarly adapted to Italian music, especially that of the soft and plaintive kind." Franklin plunges into a 4.5-page set of instructions for building this instrument. He begins by recalling an Irish inventor who once arranged wine glasses on a table and filled each to a different depth. Then he created tunes by rubbing their rims. You've seen that trick done, and you know that it's very hard to play anything rhythmical as you lurch from glass to glass. But Franklin had figured out how to create real music with rubbed glasses. He had a glass blower make a set of glass hemispheres ranging in size. Each had a hub with a hole at the center, and it tapered outward to the rim. He then ground each hemisphere until it played 1 pitch accurately. Next, he mounted all the hemispheres on a 3-foot spindle from the lowest tone to the highest. To play this Christmas tree of nested glass bowls, Franklin mechanized the process. He mounted a flywheel with an 18-pound lead rim on one end of the spindle. He put the whole arrangement on a small table and provided a foot treadle to spin the flywheel and the glass bowls. The performer could now sit at a table, pedal the machine, and place his fingers on the rim of successive glass bowls to create a tune. Franklin also color-coded the 7 notes of the scale with the 7 rainbow colors. The lowest note, a bass singer's low G, was blue, A was indigo, B purple, and so on up to a soprano high G. Franklin tells players to wash the glasses in their fingers thoroughly, then apply just a bit of chalk dust to the fingers. He concludes by saying that the instrument's tones are incomparably sweet, that they may be swelled or softened at pleasure, that they may be continued to any length, and that the instrument, being once well-tuned, never again wants tuning. Franklin fairly glows with pride in his accomplishment. He's as pleased with this as with his work on electricity or later the U.S. Constitution. He finishes his letter by saying, "In honor of your musical language, I have borrowed from it the name of this instrument, calling it the harmonica." History has largely forgotten Franklin's musical instrument and often muddies the water by calling it a glass harmonica, adding an H and hopelessly confusing readers. But this was no mouth organ. It was a truly unique American invention, which a few people are at last taking up today, over 200 years later. More important, it was emblematic of the colony's rising will to be independent from their motherland, and it is to that profoundly important assertion of musical independence that we turn next.